So biographer Ron Chernow is known for long books about giants of history, most of whom have not really been given the deep biographical look before Chernow took up the pen. John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, Alexander Hamilton, and others. But Chernow's latest book is about a mainstream heavyweight with hundreds of biographies with his name on them, George Washington. Chernow does Washington in his new book called Washington, A Life. And yesterday, Ron Chernow sat down in our studio and called Washington a man of conscience, humility, and duty, with major themes of personal transformation during his lifetime, though. For instance, one theme was a bit of a revelation. How did Washington go from being a conniving suck-up to the British military to try to get ahead in his career in the colonies to eventually become the fighting rebel and patriot we think of today?
That's an excellent point, because George Washington does not start out as a heroic figure. As a young man, he feels bitter towards the British because he's denied a royal commission. He feels bitter to them because they sell him shoddy, overpriced goods from London. He feels bitter because they ban settlement in the Western country where he's accumulating land. Then suddenly what happens with the Stamp Act and the Townshend duties, the Intolerable Acts, suddenly George Washington discovers that his personal grievances, in fact, really reflect universal problems, that the cards are stacked against the colonists, and this man who in many ways has been pursuing money, status, and power suddenly is passionately pursuing the cause of freedom and liberty.
But it seems that's the key to Washington as a kind of universal American figure. There were ideologues like John Adams who, of course, came to American patriotism as a political framework.
Yes.
The fact that he could put his personal grievances with Britain into a larger political context, he took the leap that every American would take in the 1700s and early 1800s.
Exactly. And this is the case of a man who's ennobled by circumstance. I very often say to people, you know, when you're dealing with a Hamilton, an Adams, a Jefferson, a Madison, they probably would have sparkled in almost any period, whereas George Washington finds this particular historical moment, and he so far transcends his origins. This was a man who was capable of tremendous self-criticism. I mean, he's born into a world where slavery is commonplace and unquestioned, and certainly he doesn't question it. By the end of his life, he becomes the only founder who frees his own slaves. Mm-hmm. So this is a man who turns out to be capable of extraordinary growth.
A skeptic of the Bill of Rights as president?
Well, he was skeptical, as a lot of people were. They thought that the Bill of Rights was a tactical ruse in order to defeat it. But actually what happened was that Madison asked Washington for a letter that he could circulate to the Congress to convince them to pass the Bill of Rights. And Washington gave Madison that letter. And historians now credit that letter as having a major influence in terms of the passage. So Washington indeed ends up on the right side, thank God, of that issue.
And Washington's endorsement, critical to the passage of probably the most important body of law in American
history. Yes, and I think that people, you know, don't associate him with a freedom of conscience, for instance, as much as maybe they do a Jefferson or a Madison. But one of the great letters in terms of religious freedom and tolerance was written by George mm-hmm. Washington to the Jewish congregation in Newport, Rhode Island, worth quoting in the midst of the mosque controversy, because
sure.
The head of the congregation wrote to Washington asking for reassurance that Jews would receive full civil rights. And George Washington writes back, "Happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, asks only that those who reside under its protection should acquit themselves, that is, behave themselves as good citizens." We've really never had a more beautiful statement of religious tolerance than that.
Why did Washington have such credibility among the Catherine the Greats of the world, the European leaders who really looked to Washington as a model for leadership in a Europe that was filled with turmoil?
Well, in December 1783, George Washington goes to Annapolis, where the Congress happened to be seated at that point, to tender his resignation after 8.5 years as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army. When the painter Benjamin West mentioned to George III that Washington was going to surrender his power and return to his plantation at Mount Vernon, George III said if he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world, because history was filled with instances of, you know, the general on horseback who amassed great power after his victories and then parlayed it not only into power but into tyrannical power. And here was a man who was voluntarily divesting himself of all of this extraordinary power. The fact that Washington, you know, didn't grasp for power made people more eager to grant him power. Mm.
Washington's death, perhaps the first fully national event in American history.
Yes, you know, and it's interesting, John, because by that point he had become a very controversial figure. During the first year or two of his first term, he's something of a political untouchable. He's a sacred figure. But in fact, Washington, who much like President Obama wanted to rise above partisanship and have a civilized discourse, ends up presiding over the emergence of the two-party system. The two-party system emerges within his own cabinet with Hamilton, his Treasury Secretary, leading one party, or faction, as they called it, and Jefferson, the Secretary of State, the other. But when Washington died, suddenly people realized that, in fact, this man was the embodiment of the nation. He defeated the British Empire in the war. He had presided over the Constitutional Convention as president, and he had forged the office of the presidency during his first two terms in office. These are achievements that I think no other president can match.
It's irresistible to compare George Washington to Cincinnatus, it seems, in some ways, and you do a couple of times in this book. Climb into his mind for us, as only a Ron Chernow can do. At the end of it all, his beloved Mount Vernon, the place that he loved so much throughout his presidency, throughout his life, early life, middle and late life. Do you think he looked out at the Potomac River and said, you know, I wish I'd just stayed here the whole time?
Well, I think he made tremendous sacrifices. People don't realize the extent to which he sacrificed. He was commander-in-chief of the Continental Army for 8.5 years. During that 8.5-year period, he only returned home once for 3 days. He then goes back to Mount Vernon, hoping for a little bit of, you know, peace and tranquility. He's pulled out to become president of the Constitutional Convention. Even John, when he became president, he said to himself and confided to a few intimates that he was only going to serve as president for a year or two, establish the legitimacy of the government, and then step down. There was always another crisis where his cabinet would say, you can't leave in the midst of this crisis. But I think Washington had a powerful vision of America as a strong, prosperous country, and I think most importantly, as an honorable and just country. And I think that it's the honorable and just that is arguably his most important legacy. As we know, we have become very rich and very strong as well.
And he saw that through to the end.
Yeah, he did.
Indeed. Ron Chernow, thanks so much. Washington, A Life, the latest biography from Ron Chernow. Thanks.
Great pleasure, John. Thank you.
Lots of things to learn about George Washington, even so long after the founding of this nation. This great hour was brought to you in part by the great work of our producer, Jen Poyant. She also helped to bring us the guest from the Westboro Baptist Church, whose family argues it's their constitutional right to protest outside the funerals of America's fallen soldiers. Here's Nate Phelps.
What I learned growing up there was that they think that God's the one who makes the decisions about who's saved and who goes to hell, and that it's only a very select few, and the group of elect became smaller and smaller over the years in my father's mind, and they reason out that since they have been chosen out of, you know, the billions of people, that there must be some reason, and that they've got to discover that reason within the Bible and then react to it, respond to it.
Nate Phelps, A Man in the Middle. Thank you, Jen Poyant. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.